Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, September 7, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will discuss updates on patent law and antitrust. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Mr. Philip Johnson, Senior Vice President of Intellectual Property and Strategy and Policy at Johnson & Johnson, Professor Kristin Osenga, Professor of Law at the University of Richmond School of Law, Mr. Robert G. Stern, Director at Stern Kessler Goldstein Fox, and our moderator, Mr. Howard J. Klein, Attorney at Klein, O'Neill, and Singh. Mr. Howard has been a patent prosecutor for over 40 years, and he is also a former member of the Patent Public Advisory Committee. After his opening remarks, we'll go to Ian's question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura. I appreciate those remarks. This afternoon, we'll be discussing patent law and antitrust, and specifically, the topic will be recent developments in U.S. patent law, particularly the AIA and the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on patent-eligible subject matter. These have raised questions of whether and to what extent the constitutional directive to promote technological innovation has been undermined or frustrated. The panel will discuss whether the U.S. is shifting from a view of patents as private property to one of public rights, and if so, whether concepts from antitrust law will begin to color, if not dominate, patent enforcement jurisprudence. The practical implications of a public rights view of patents and the imposition of antitrust issues on the enforcement of patent rights will also be discussed. Our panel today is a very distinguished panel, and we're very, very pleased to have them. We will be led off by Mr. Philip Johnson, who will discuss, give us some background and the current legal landscape. Mr. Johnson, as you've heard, is served as Senior Vice President in the Law Department and Chief Intellectual Property Counsel of Johnson & Johnson, where he managed about 110 patent and trademark attorneys worldwide. He is the Chair of the Board of Directors of the American Intellectual Property Law Education Foundation, Vice President and President-elect of the Intellectual Property Owners Association, and where he's also on the Educational Foundation. He's past president of that. He has a degree in biology from Bucknell, cum laude, and his JD from Harvard, where his third-year advisor is now Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Our second speaker, Professor Kristin Osenga, will discuss the issue of patents as private rights versus public or quasi-public rights, and also current trends, such as the case now pending before the Supreme Court of the Oil States case. Professor Jacobson teaches and writes at University of Richmond School of Law, and writes in the areas of intellectual property, patent law, law and language, legislation and regulation. She focuses on the intersection between law and linguistics and patent claim construction, as well as other aspects of patent law, and has appeared and spoken in a number of venues and symposium. Prior to joining academia, she practiced patent law and clerked for Judge Richard Lynn of the Federal Circuit, and she's also been a visiting professor at Emory University School of Law and William & Mary School of Law. Our final speaker today is Mr. Robert Stern, who will be discussing the practical implications of a dominating public rights view of patents, and Mr. Stern is a founding director of Stern, Kessler, Goldstein, and Fox, which is one of the nation's foremost patent intellectual property firms based in Washington, D.C. He has extensive expertise in AIA post-issuance proceedings and concurrent patent litigation, ITC investigations, Federal Circuit appeals, EU enforcement, and a variety of other aspects of patent acquisition and enforcement. He is editor-in-chief of Patent Office Litigation and Patent Office Litigation Second Edition. He has a JD from the University of Maryland with honors and master's in engineering from Tufts and a BS in electrical engineering from Tufts. So I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Johnson for the background and current legal landscape.
Thank you very much, Howard. First, I'd like to comment that time flies, and the CV you were using must be a little out of date because I've now completed a two-year term as president of Intellectual Property Owners and serve on the executive committee of that. And there were a few other minor changes, such as my recent retirement of J&J. So anyone who's interested, try LinkedIn. I have a more recent CV up for your reference. But thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. My job, which is an impossible one, is in just a few minutes describe the legal landscape and intellectual property law, especially patent law, and how it has been changing. And I will try to do that by focusing on three different areas. First of all, I'll look at the Supreme Court jurisprudence and point to a few decisions that have substantially undermined the effective enforceability of U.S. patents. Going back some 10 years, the Supreme Court was confronted with questions about whether patent owners who had won patent infringement suits should be entitled to obtain injunctions to stop those infringements as a matter of right. And instead of holding, as had generally been the case before that decision, that patent owners are entitled to exercise the right to exclude, the Supreme Court laid out a multifactorial test of considerations that could be taken into account in deciding whether or not a court could nonetheless deny an injunction and, in essence, allow the infringement to continue. And that was, I think, a sea change in the approach of the Supreme Court and of the courts to protecting the right to exclude, which is promised by the Constitution to U.S. patent owners. The next decision of note was the KSR case, which was a case relating to obviousness. And there was a feeling at the time in the case law that in order for a patent or an invention to be declared obvious, it was not enough to be able to show that you needed that each element of the invention happened to appear somewhere in the prior art, and so that with hindsight they could be assembled together to get whatever the inventor was now claiming. But instead, the Federal Circuit was using what was called a TSM test, teaching, suggestion, and motivation test, to say it must be more than that. It's not enough that different pieces of an invention might be available in the prior art. There must be some reason for one of ordinary skill in the art to combine those in order to make an invention obvious. Well, the Supreme Court rejected the TSMK test, saying there is no hard and fast test, and said, in essence, well, you can use common sense and in order to find something obvious, and thereby taking away one of the principal protections against obviousness, which had existed for a long time in patent law, and that is taking away the guard against hindsight. Because, of course, as we all know, once an invention is had, almost all of us look back on it and say, well, using hindsight, that was obvious. But the fact of the matter is, those inventions are seldom, if ever, obvious when the invention has not yet been had. Moving even further forward than that, the Supreme Court then, in a quartet of decisions, which are referred to as Mayo, Myriad, Prometheus, and Alice, addressed the subject matter that could be patented. Now, going back to 1952, which was the original codification of the modern patent laws, it was very clear in Congress and in the House and Senate reports at the time that the subject matter that was to be patentable was intended to be very broad, pertaining to, quote, anything under the sun that is made by man, unquote, provided the other conditions of the statute are met, such as that it must be new, useful, and non-obvious. Well, the court has upset that settled expectation in these cases, and it's done so by stretching the interpretations of some judicially made exceptions to patentable subject matter. And those exceptions were traditionally recited as being an invention can't be entirely abstract, an invention can't claim a law of nature, an invention can't properly claim a natural phenomenon. But of course, every invention, to some degree or other, relies upon an abstract idea, a concept, or a law of nature, such as gravity, or a natural phenomenon, such as how the human body works. But it, up until this quartet of cases, it had generally been thought that the fact that there was some implication of one of those exceptions was not what the prohibition was. It had to be that the patent owner was claiming nothing more than, say, the law of nature. So it was often said you couldn't claim the law of gravity. But now the Supreme Court has taken a different turn in these cases and is essentially looking at whether the invention preempts some aspect of a law of nature or a natural phenomenon, or whether the invention is a discovery of a natural phenomenon, even if put to a practical use. And as a result, there's quite frankly a complete upset in the determination of what patentable subject matter is. The Supreme Court has laid down some criteria or given some guideposts, but in some cases, the examples are technically inaccurate, and in other cases, they're conflicting, leaving the patent office and the profession in somewhat of a quandary in areas such as software analogs and in the medical field, diagnostic testing, and in some cases, therapeutic applications, as to whether or not they run afoul of the Supreme Court's new prohibitions on what's patentable. So that is one area where we've had a substantial erosion of predictable patent rights. Now, the second area is the result of the American Invents Act, which was passed in 2012. And I'll say largely perhaps an unintended result of the American Invents Act, a primary purpose of which was to try to harmonize the U.S. patent laws to allow us to move to a first inventor to file system rather than a first to invent system. And that part of the law actually has not created much of a problem. I mean, there have been normal transition issues. But also as part of this, the Congress enacted several post-grant proceedings, which for the first time would allow any member of the public to, in essence, start a judicial proceeding within the patent office, an adjudication within the patent office, before a special panel of administrative patent judges. These proceedings are known as post-grant reviews, inter-parties reviews, and covered business method reviews. And these proceedings allow any member of the public to file a petition asking the patent office, in essence, to invalidate an existing U.S. patent. Now, there's somewhat different eligibility rules that apply, and these proceedings vary somewhat, but I'll focus in particular on IPRs, that is, inter-parties reviews, which are proceedings that can be brought against patents throughout their entire lives, and which, as implemented by the Patent Office, have produced what the former chief judge of the Federal Circuit has called a killing field for patents. In fact, he's called the patent trademark Board of Judges, which is affectionately known as the PTAB, he's called them a death squad. And unfortunately, it does appear that at least some people, including former chief judge of that panel, James Smith, they apparently see that their job, the job Congress gave them, was to be a death squad, because James Smith explained as much in one of the PPAC meetings when he was asked. He said if they weren't doing some death squatting, they wouldn't be doing the job that Congress gave them to do. Well, obviously, this is hostile to patents. And in fact, the track record of these IPR proceedings has borne that out, as some 80% of the patents that are now subjected to these IPR proceedings are found invalid in whole or in part. Some, by some reckoning, much more than 80%. On top of that, these proceedings have turned into a way for accused infringers to harass patent owners, because there are no effective prohibitions against serial filing of these proceedings against patent owners. So if the challenger to the patent fails the first time in filing an IPR, there are no effective limitations against them filing a second, a third, a fourth. And in fact, of over 5,000 petitions that have been filed against patents so far, just under half of them involve second or subsequent challenges to the same patent. And these are obviously very expensive, as any adjudicatory proceeding is. They're $300,000 to $700,000 a piece. And so if you're an individual inventor and you're trying to license your patent or assert your patent against someone who's not wanting to pay your royalties, you can be hit with one or more of these proceedings, and essentially, perhaps from the transaction costs alone, in many cases, be forced into an unfavorable settlement. In addition to just establishing these proceedings, their problems, really from start to finish, involve procedures and rules that are hostile to patent owners, beginning with the fact that, unlike the way patents are normally construed in the courts, according to the plain and ordinary meaning of the patent claims, the patent office has decided that they'll construe those claims differently, giving them their broadest reasonable interpretation, which makes them much more susceptible to invalidation than they would be in court. Also, the patent office has decided that under that interpretation, there's no requirement that they look back at the original record that led to the grant of the patent, and what the patent claims were decided to mean in the interchange with the original examiner. So they gave no deference to prior findings of the office at all, and they think nothing of instituting IPR proceedings based on the same or substantially the same prior art that was originally considered during the prosecution of the patent before it was granted. So these and a number of other unfortunate developments have led to situations where a phenomenon known as efficient infringement is now common, and that is a situation where people who might otherwise have sought and obtained licenses under third-party patents before undertaking a commercial venture are now quite frequently simply ignoring those patents, doing whatever they want, using them as they want, and then feeling that should the patent owner try to assert the patents against them, that they will simply start these IPR proceedings against the patent owner, and that they have a very high likelihood of success given the way the deck is stacked in favor of challengers. So I wish I could give you a more positive overview, but I think I'm sure I'm probably out of time, but that is the legal landscape as I see it at the moment.
Thank you, Philip. It's discouraging, but I think obviously it's important that we understand what we're facing, those of us who have been laboring in the patent field for a long time. We don't look at these developments with any great degree of enthusiasm, to say the least. Let me turn this over to Kristen Osenga, who will look at it from the perspective of private property, patents as private property versus public rights.
Thanks, Howard. Sybil laid out a number of Supreme Court cases in the past that had a serious impact on the patent landscape and also gave you a really nice overview of the problems in the IPR, or inter-parties review, post-grant review proceedings. And what I'm going to spend the bulk of my remarks on is a Supreme Court case that's going to be heard this upcoming term that has a serious potential to have a lot of fallout on patent law, but also deals directly with those IPRs that Phil just explained to you. So as Howard introduced the Teleforum, he talked about how patents are being increasingly treated as quasi-public or public rights. And one explanation for a number of recent changes in patent law, including the increased use of antitrust in the patent sphere, is because we're deviating from a pretty basic core principle that patents are property rights. And there's probably no better illustration of this phenomenon today, this shift of patents from private rights to quasi-public or public rights, than the upcoming Supreme Court case in Oil States Energy Services versus Greens Energy Group. So the issue, as it's framed in the question presented at the Supreme Court in this Oil States case, is whether inter-parties review, or IPR, which is the process that Phil explained earlier, whether that violates the Constitution by extinguishing private property rights through a non-Article III forum without a jury. So let me take some time to try to make this issue a little more clear. Oil States owns a patent related to fracking, which is totally not important to the story, but it's always good to say. It sued a competitor, Greens Energy, and Greens Energy responded, as Phil noted, by asking the PTO to institute an IPR and have the patent invalidated. So as Phil mentioned, IPR is one of a suite of post-grant proceedings that allows issued patents to be revisited by the PTO and, unfortunately, often invalidated. So the intent of the post-grant proceedings set up by the AIA was good. It's good to allow the PTO to correct its errors, to allow it to invalidate patents that should not have been granted in the first place. That's a noble idea. But the way the proceedings are playing out in real life is that many patents are being invalidated in proceedings that are incredibly slanted against patent owners. And I know Phil alluded to this. I also want to give a shout out to the Regulatory Transparency Project of the Federalist Society. Has an entire white paper on the problems with the post-grant proceedings, and also had held an interesting podcast a week or two ago discussing the problems plaguing post-grant review. So I'm not going to explain a whole lot more here. If you want to hear me talk more about it, I'm actually part of that podcast. So anyway, so the issue today is really how patents are being treated more like quasi-public or public rights than the property rights they actually are. So going back to Oil States, the alleged infringer asked the PTO to invalidate it. The PTO instituted an IPR, held the claims to be unpatentable, invalidated the patent. Oil States then appealed to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, challenging both the merits of the decision but also arguing that IPRs are unconstitutional. And the specific argument is that suits to invalidate a patent should be tried before a jury in an Article III court, rather than before the administrative patent judges that sit at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, or the PTAB. The post-grant review procedures that were delegated through the EIAA to the administrative agency, the PTO, Oil States argues, is thus unconstitutional. So the Federal Circuit was not swayed by this argument. It pointed to some of its earlier precedent that patents are public rights, not private property rights, and affirmed the PTO's invalidation of the patent. So then Oil States petitioned the Supreme Court for certiorari on the constitutional question, and the Supreme Court requested briefing from the Solicitor General's office. And the SG argued in the brief that it submitted to the Supreme Court that patents are a public right, and therefore there is nothing unconstitutional about the PTO invalidating patents it just granted, particularly since the proceedings are intended to invalidate patents that should never have been issued in the first place. The Supreme Court granted cert, and so now we have the Oil States case that will be heard this term. So for those who support the constitutionality of IPRs and the post-grant review scheme, the key argument that side makes is that patents are public rights. This argument is generally that The normal course of the argument is this. Congress cannot take cases away from Article III courts, but there are exceptions to the general rule. And one of the exceptions allows Congress to vest adjudication of public rights in these non-Article III courts. So we have to determine what is a public right versus a private right to know if it needs to be before an Article III court or if it can be heard administratively. And the question generally is whether the right is integrally related to a federal government action, such that the right is so closely integrated into a public regulatory scheme as to be appropriate for agency resolution. So that's the language that keeps coming up in these. So we need to show that patents are a public right to make it okay to take it out of the court system and back into the patent office. And so the argument goes, again, from the side that believes that IPRs are constitutional, patent rights were created by statute and then granted by the patent office through this elaborate scheme of statutes and agency regulations. And because of that, this has led the SG's office and others to conclude, and I quote here from the SG's brief to the Supreme Court, quote, patents are quintessential public rights. And in my perspective, my viewpoint, is that this particular viewpoint, the idea that patents are quintessential public rights, is to blame for the weakening of patent rights and also the increased reliance on antitrust and other non-patent doctrines to deal with what should actually be intellectual property issues. But there is another viewpoint, and one that I personally hope will prevail in the oil states case, and that is this. Patents are private, not public rights. So this is the flip side of the argument made by the SG and some amici at the Supreme Court, and that is that patents are private, not public rights, and therefore should be heard in Article III courts. So there's two reasons that I'll put forward as to why patents are private rights. First, history supports that patents are private property rights. And second, the analogies, and this is related, analogies to other public rights, given the long history that supports the private rights, just simply don't fly. So on the first point, there's ample historical evidence. In the form of Supreme Court cases going way back in time, back to the 19th century, that patents are private rights. So specifically in a case from 1882 called James versus Campbell, the court said, a patent confers upon the patentee an exclusive property in the patented invention, which cannot be appropriated or used by the government without just compensation, any more than it can appropriate or use without compensation land, which has been patented to a private purchaser. So going way back into Supreme Court jurisprudence about patent law, it's a private property right akin to that in land. Okay? And many other cases refer to patents as private property rights in a similar fashion. More importantly, as private property rights, there's also case law that patents create this vested property right that creates a constitutional security, just like it does with other types of property. So in an 1898 case, again, looking at history, the Supreme Court plainly stated that once a patent issues, it has become the property of the patentee, and as such is entitled to the same legal protection as other property. So again, looking at this as private property rights. Now, the Solicitor General's brief in the oil states case and others seem to indicate that this is old law and the new modern administrative state has, in fact, turned the tide and changed the law from these historic cases, but that's not actually a fair characterization. As recently as 2015, the Supreme Court in the Horn versus Department of Ag case quoted the very same language from James versus Campbell that I read to you earlier. So it's not old law, a tired law that doesn't exist anymore. So on the second point, which is related as to why these should actually be private rights rather than quasi-public or public rights, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in a case called MCM Portfolio versus Hewlett-Packard said that patents are public rights, and that language is being repeated over and over again now in the oil states briefing. And part of what led the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit to that point was that they were analogizing patents to rights that have arisen in other administrative agencies. But the rights in the cases that they point to, in one case arising from OSHA and another arising from the Clean Water Act, don't come with this long-standing history of Supreme Court jurisprudence that plainly imbues patents with private property status and rights. And so the rights that the Federal Circuit uses in its analogy that then is being set forward today and with the oil states case, those rights may be an example of quasi-public rights that arise from the modern administrative state, but they're not akin to patent rights. So this is just a summary of the historical basis for why patents should be treated as a private property right. and how the statements that patents are instead public or quasi-public rights are not really supportable because it's in direct contradiction with this long-standing Supreme Court precedent. There's a lot of other really great quotations and stuff in a number of briefs out there, and I suggest that you look into it if you're interested, because there's lots more history than I can give you in the 10 minutes I get today. But at the very bottom of it, the Federal Circuit, the SG's office, and others are wrongly moving, and this is, it's happening over time, but it's moving further and further in this direction, wrongly moving the conception of patent rights from a private property right to a quasi-public or public right. And the problem is that that then opens patents up to all sorts of non-patent doctrine that is making patent enforcement very problematic. So in some respects, patent owners themselves are having to look outside patent law to exercise and receive the benefits that should accrue from their patents. And in other respects, non-patent doctrines such as antitrust are being used as a tool to kind of cabin in or even quash patent holders from trying to enforce these rights. And regardless of whether it's the patent owners that are looking outside or others looking outside, that's a big problem, because patent law is where this is supposed to be happening. So at this point, I don't want to talk any further. I want to turn it over to Rob, because I think he can give you a much better sense of the types of problems moving from private to public rights is causing for the patent world. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Kristen. Rob, yes, that's a great intro, so I'll turn it right over to you.
Well, thank you all, and I want to approach this very broad topic from the perspective of the impact that it is causing in the business community and in the innovation community in the United States and around the world. The practical reality is that the business community for the last decade has been hammered with the idea that there has been a whole rash of patents that were issued by the USPTO starting at the height of the dot-com boom that were so-called bad patents, and that these patents are being exploited in an illegitimate way towards legitimate businesses and being used to tax them and extort them, if you will, for royalties. And it is true that there have been a lot of patents that were issued during this time frame that did not receive the level of scrutiny that was probably warranted at the time. But again, to use an analogy, we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as you can see by the developments that have been outlined by Phil and Kristen today. So from the business world perspective, patents are very important in most industry areas today, if not more important than ever. Business people are not going to invest large sums of money and take risk in innovation if they do not have a solid expectation that their investment is going to be properly taken care of by the legal system. And this is why the concept of property rights are so important, because to the business world, it is property. It's no different than a building that they've invested in or other types of real or personal property. So patent rights are the fundamental bedrock of the investment community's expectation concerning taking risk in highly risky innovation efforts. The idea that you cannot protect your innovation once you win, because it's now become a public right that can be taken away with relative impunity, is something that is antithetical to an investor's perception. And therefore, what we're going to see and are already starting to see is a retreat by the investment community to invest in innovation in the United States and to move their investments to other jurisdictions that have more solid and predictable patent systems, such as the European Union, particularly in Germany, and also, surprisingly, in the last couple of years, the People's Republic of China. So give you some practical examples of the shift in attitude that we see today. Historically, in the electronics industry, you want to have standards. And these standards are to bring about wide proliferation of particular types of electronic innovation. But what's happening now with standard-setting bodies is that the impact of the antitrust laws on these standard-setting bodies have taken standard-setting patents under these regimes from being the most valuable to the least valuable patents in the electronics world, because the level of royalties that you can obtain for standard-setting patents have gone to all-time lows. So we're now seeing industry fractionalization, where industry innovators who spend hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars putting together a new standard are retreating from these standard-setting bodies and doing it alone. And why is that happening? It's happening because these standard-setting patterns are no longer being given the type of value and exclusivity that we are accustomed to in the past. We're going to see other types of behavior from the investment community that are not good for the innovation competitiveness of the United States. Phil has talked about the statutory subject matter issue, which is extraordinarily pernicious because it attacks the most leading-edge technologies that we have in the world today, the computer-based technologies, the diagnostics, all of the great work being done in the area of medical technology. All of this is no longer certain to be statutory subject matter in the United States. So if you turn it from a property right to a public right, you can see that the carve-out of what is patentable subject matter could become even greater. So I think that the business community is waking up to these changes. They don't know what to do, but they are going to be very careful, I think, going forward with their investment decisions and where to make them, in what countries, and under what patent systems. And I would submit to you that this whole public right argument that's been made by the administration is actually going to ultimately hurt job creation, innovation, and investment in the United States. So I'll turn it back over to you, Howard, at this time.
Oh, thanks, Rob. At this point, we're going to, if there's any interplay, any of the other speakers, panelists, wish to comment on anything that's been said so far, now would be a good time to jump in before we turn it over to the audience for Q&A. So does anybody on the panel wish to comment on what's we've discussed so far?
Well, this is Phil. I'd like to add a little bit to what Rob has just said about the impact on innovation, because there are several other pernicious results of where we are. One of them is that people will keep what they're doing as trade secrets. One of the greatest benefits of the U.S. patent system and other patent systems is that in return for patent protection, inventors are required to disclose the details of their invention so that others can take that into account and use that as knowledge that can be applied to making still further improvements and other inventions. And that is being discouraged because when the patent rights are no longer as reliable. And you do see some businesses now that are doing better, that are maintaining a good bit of what they do secret, which they're, of course, entitled to do. The other thing that is happening, which I think is very unfortunate, is that these rules on patentable subject matter are skewing where research money is going. It is moving away from areas that is very important, as, for example, the diagnostic work and other work that is related to personalized medicine, and into areas that are more conventional areas that are not subject to these restrictions. And finally, I'd point out that uncertainty in patent protection hurts the early stage inventions and basic discoveries the most, because they're the ones that are riskiest to begin with. They're the ones that are more abstract, more reliant on natural phenomena and laws of nature, and they've become much less reliable than, say, your ordinary minor improvement in a mechanical device. And so, unfortunately, the research investment is being deterred from going exactly where we most want it as a society, because it's those upstream inventions that are most likely to change and improve the quality of human life.
Okay. Thank you, Philip. Anybody else care to comment at this point on the panel?
This is Kristen. I just wanted to reiterate something that Rob said I think is so incredibly important, which is the effect that this move to public or quasi-public rights for patents is going to have on the fields of standards. Already we're seeing an awful lot of antitrust action in the standards fields, and the thing that I'm sure everybody on this call knows, but that a lot of people just simply don't think about, is how integral to today's life, society, happiness, standardized technology is. It's everywhere in everything we do and everything we rely on. And so to the extent that this move to the public rights idea is going to discourage participation in standardization and the antitrust suits that are coming into the field of standardized technology, it could have a very, very sweeping impact on not just those companies, but also all of us and our enjoyment of life.
This is Phil. As a corollary to the public rights idea, comes with it the fact that if patents are no longer private property, they're not going to be subject to the protections offered under the 5th and 14th Amendments. So they could be taken without due process and without just compensation, which is just unthinkable when you realize that patents are a major part of many companies' balance sheets now. Intellectual property is a major value driver for most companies, and much of the stock market values companies based on their IP.
Well, I'll just toss something out there. Does anybody believe that we're heading toward a compulsory license regime in the U.S.? Is there a danger of that, or is that an overblown fear?
Well, this is Rob speaking again. I think we really, in many respects, have that now. Under the present rules that have been created in the last 10 years, if you're representing a patent owner of any size, I don't care if it's the largest company in the world, and you go to court in the United States, you can't get an injunction in most situations, particularly if it's a very large liability exposure. And so under the efficient infringement strategy that's being practiced extensively by all types of enterprises these days, as Phil was explaining that phenomena, essentially it's cheaper and more prudent if you are a competitor to just do what you want to do and take the consequences later, kick the infringement liability down the road, so to speak, using the PTAB as a mechanism to do this, so that the PTAB is not really achieving the faster, cheaper, and better objectives that it was purported to introduce into the system. So I would argue that for a patent owner today in the United States, we effectively do have a compulsory license scheme, particularly in the non-medical fields.
Does anybody else want to comment on that? Or would we like to take questions from the audience? Okay.
Let's go to audience questions.
Let's go to the audience questions if we have any. That'd be
great. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. Howard, did you have any follow-up for our panel?
Yeah, I was good. Well, I'll follow up with, to the extent that we are, you know, it's clear that we are drifting into some very anti-patent realm here. Is there any sector, or who is really driving, where is the drive for this, you know, this public rights view of patents coming from? Or did this just some sort of spring out of some, you know, out of the PTO or the courts or Congress, or is there something driving, someone or some sector driving this whole issue in the direction that that is alarming us?
Well, this is Phil. I think some of the drive is coming from people that you might think of as technology aggregators who benefit by taking a large number of different technologies or different improvements and aggregating them into a single product or service. And for those, I mean, those people will argue that there are simply too many patents out there for them to study and worry about whether they're infringing them or not, and that they are providing a kind of innovation that comes from putting lots of different technologies together. They'll point to their products and say there are 200 or 300 or 1,000 patents involved in making a product. And so efficiency is important for those people. There are also owners of large portfolios who may find it beneficial to have many patents because no one is going to be able to attack their portfolio overall, but not have any single patent be particularly enforceable. Because a single patent owned by an independent inventor or small business may threaten the market position of a well-entrenched competitor.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
This is Kristen. I don't know if it's being, I don't have an answer to your particular question of whether or not it's being driven by a particular industry or anyone, but I do want to point out the Federal Circuit isn't helping things along. If anything, they're aiding and abetting this move to a public rights viewpoint of patent law through their opinions on this constitutional issue and more. They certainly have a lot to say at the things that Phil talked about with the statutory subject matter and injunctions. And so they may not be the drivers, but they are certainly creating a lot of law that is helping this along.
If we still have no questions from the audience, I just throw something out there. Does anybody on the panel think that there's any kind of fix, either legislative or judicial or administrative, that will hopefully, if not reverse this trend, at least stop it where it is?
Well, this is Phil. We've obviously talked about the oil states case. And if the Supreme Court finds IPR to be unconstitutional, that will obviously stop it, at least for a while, unless Congress is able to come up with some other approach to accomplishing the same or a similar result. We also right now have a new patent office director who's been nominated. I saw the name just was passed to the Senate for consideration and confirmation. And many of the things that we have talked about are discretionary decisions that have been made by the prior leadership in the patent office, such as the claimant interpretation standard that I mentioned and others. And certainly a different patent office director with the support of an administration could make a big difference in terms of how these are run and whether they're run. The American Invents Act actually placed in the hands of the director the discretion not to institute these proceedings and not to institute them for a whole variety of reasons, including whether it was in the best interests of the economy or integrity of the patent system, or whether, for example, the issues had already been adequately considered previously in the patent office, whether the proceeding could not efficiently be conducted within the 12-month limit that the statute requires, and many other reasons. But prior leadership in the patent office to date has simply not exercised any of the discretionary power that they were given. In fact, instead of having the director make these decisions as to whether or not to institute IPRs, the initially adopted rules bypass the director altogether and send these to this board of patent judges, who really were not contemplated to make the decision as to whether or not to institute, but only to make a decision if the director had decided to institute as to whether or not there were good grounds. So there are a great many things that could happen in the patent office. And of course, Congress could always step in and fix it. Senator Coons has introduced a bipartisan piece of legislation known as the Stronger Patents Act, and it addresses many of the things that we have talked about on this call. But so far, that bill has not been moved forward by the leadership of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions yet from the audience?
We do not. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
Okay. Well, while we're waiting for... Hello?
Go ahead.
Is this a question from the audience coming in?
No, it's not. We're still waiting.
I'm sorry. I thought I heard somebody clicking on. Okay. Does anybody else want to comment on remedies to the situation, or does anybody see any trends that might be seen as alarming? What are some worst case scenarios, for example, if for example the Supreme Court does not step in and define patents as a private property? What are the further implications, assuming Congress doesn't step in, which it seems it's not likely to do anytime soon? Where are we headed in terms of the global technology race and preserving the U.S. leadership in innovation? I mean, if any of you were testifying before Congress, for example, what would you do to grab these people by the lapels, so to speak, and say, wake up?
Well, obviously, this is Phil. Obviously, China is going in the opposite direction. They're working very hard to strengthen their patent system, and they have actually more patents filed in China now than in the rest of the developed IP world put together. And so you have a lot of local business in China patenting in a regime that will give injunctions now. You have a similar situation in Europe. So that for U.S. manufacturers exporting their products to China or Europe, they may very well face being enjoined if they run afoul of these locally granted patents. On the other hand, for European or Chinese manufacturers coming into the U.S., the threat of an injunction, as Rob has mentioned, is really not on the table. So from that standpoint, we're at a international trade competitive disadvantage. And actually, the only thing that keeps it from being worse is that the International Trade Commission thus far has not followed the patent office line in terms of weakening patent rights.
Any other comments on that?
It looks like we have two questions pending, so we can go to our first audience question.
Hey, It sounds like, thanks for doing this teleform. It sounds like all of you agree that IPRs are a bad idea for the economy, and maybe also that they are unconstitutional. So if you're predicting, do you think we'll see a pretty easy decision from the Supreme Court striking down IPRs?
I don't know. This is Kristen. I'm not sure if it's an easy decision. I think two things. One, I think there's so much Supreme Court precedent that the Supreme Court is likely to continue on its viewpoint that that patents are private rights, and so that's one thing I think. And also, you know, very few times it happens, but very few times does the Supreme Court take a Federal Circuit case to say, "Woohoo, way to go, Federal Circuit, you got it right." So usually there's at least some sort of cabining in of whatever the Federal Circuit says if the Supreme Court takes it. So I do think that something's in the mix. I don't think this is just going to be a, okay, carry on as usual. But I do want to clarify one thing you said, though, questioner, which is I'm not entirely convinced that IPRs are all bad. There's definitely a constitutional question that I think needs to be answered. But I also think there needs to be some realistic and effective mechanisms to look at patents that are not necessarily well granted. I just don't think the IPR system as it's set up is the right way.
Anybody else want to chime in on that?
I just note that the Supreme Court that we're talking about is, with one exception, the same Supreme Court that has decided many of these other issues that have gotten us where we are today. And so getting five votes in to hold them unconstitutional, I think, will be a difficult matter. And certainly, whatever this case is, it's not going to be easy, and I don't think we're going to see a unanimous decision.
So you think it'll be, they'll try to be very narrow, obviously, in their whatever ruling they come up with.
I'm not sure. I guess it depends what the majority turns out to be.
Yeah. Well, in the past, there's been, if I may say, there's been overwhelming majorities which have taken an anti-patent view, and so I'm not sanguine about the prospects going forward. But let's turn this over to there's another questioner, I'm told, so let's see if we can entertain that person's questions. Hello?
Hi. So my question is, it seems like a lot of this push towards the public right view is coming out of a perceived need for improved quality in the patents that are granted. And so if we're not going to move in the public right direction, how should we move in order to get better quality in these patents?
That's a good question. Anybody want to take a crack at that?
Well, I would say that there has been a great deal of PR with people who have been accused of infringement or who are worried about being accused, generally slandering patent quality, which isn't to say that there aren't some patents that are granted that shouldn't be granted. But when these were subjected to federal court review, patents were upheld about 70% of the time on the validity issue, as opposed to about 15% of the time in front of the PTAB. So that the question is whether this is a matter of patent quality or whether it's a matter of two different fora that have very different standards. I mean, the fact of the matter is that obviousness, which is the issue which is mostly the one that is litigated, comes down to a difficult judgment as to whether the inventor did something more than that of one of ordinary skill in the art would have done. And that is that there was something extra that led to the invention that he came up with that was not obvious at the time. And that is not a very easy, bright line rule to look at. And clearly, when you get into litigation, to the person who's accused of infringement, it's easy for them to say, oh, it was obvious, you know, they should never gotten a patent, just as the inventor feels just as strongly that it was non-obvious and fully entitled to protection. This is why we have a patent office in the first place, because they're supposed to represent the public and be a neutral arbiter of what is and what is not an invention, which is reached by patent examiners who have, by and large, have dedicated their careers to becoming experts in the particular field that they're examining and coming up with a decision as to whether or not the applicant has met the burden. And I will not say that it's always perfect, and I don't believe it will ever be perfect in any country, but I will say that to have a broad brush slander or an allegation the other way, not all patents are perfect, not all things that are granted, they don't have a 0% error rate, but their error rate is not 60 or 70 or 80%, which is what the PTAB would suggest.
Does anybody else want to comment on that point? Okay. Do we have any other questions from our audience?
We do not. Would now be a good time to go to closing remarks?
Yeah, I would just go to closing remarks now, if that's fine. Let's just go in reverse order. Rob, you want to give us our first closing remark?
Sure. I think that the real problem here is that the public, the investment public, the financial community, the high-tech community in the United States doesn't fully appreciate what's been done to the patent system in the United States, nor do they have a strong appreciation for how China, in particular, is coming on extremely fast and extremely aggressively in developing a patent system that's going to favor their market and their industry over everyone. And what I think needs to be done more and more is the word needs to go out to the press that they really understand what's happening and not just parrot this rhetoric that we've been hearing for years and years that we have all these bad patents that need to be struck down. I think a much more informed and balanced narrative in the public press is needed, and it's needed now.
Thank you, Rob. Kristen?
I think what Rob said was awesome, but also I just want to add, you know, if the Supreme Court doesn't rule that IPRs are unconstitutional, I still think that a lot of good could come if we change some of the procedures and rules for the IPRs at the Patent Office. As a number of people have spoken about today, that there's something salvageable here, even if the Supreme Court doesn't come out the way that I hope they do.
Okay, thank you. Philip, anything you'd like to add?
I really have nothing to add other than to thank the Federalist Society for having this forum. This is a very important issue, and it's very important for as many people as possible to acquaint themselves with it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and thank you. Thank you all for your participation. I thought this was a great conversation, and I echo Phil's remarks. We're facing a crisis in the protection of innovation, and unless something is done rather quickly, I think we're going to pay some very heavy prices in the future. So I have nothing further to add other than my gratitude to the panelists and to the Federalist Society personnel, staff, Laura and Dean and Julie, who have and Adam Mossoff, the IP section chairman, to that facilitated this program. And I at this point I'll turn it over to Laura to do what's necessary to finish up the call.
Thank you. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for a week from today on oh, not a week from today, from a couple days from now, on Tuesday, September 12th at 2 p.m. That call will feature a discussion on politics and federal antitrust enforcement, and will include a number of speakers. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls, and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.